From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. On the program today, a proposed mine in the UP has locals fearing for their waterways and wetlands.
One of the county commissioners up there told me he's never seen or heard of a sulfide mine anywhere that didn't kind of leave scars upon the land after its closure.
Also, we will talk to MSU's new president, Samuel Stanley, about his vision for the future.
I think it's all about creating a culture of safety, of being welcome, and of diversity and inclusion on campus. So I think all those things come together.
And we'll explore the link between climate change and human health.
I think we definitely need to be responding now to these threats, because the threats are here now.
We have to be thinking about what is our society-wide investment in protecting the most vulnerable of us.
All of that and more coming up on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber-Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. This hour, we'll be digging into how climate change is impacting human health, especially for already vulnerable communities. But first, the Menominee River marks the dividing line between Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. The river is prized for walleye, and it drains into Lake Michigan. A Canadian mining company is proposing a large open-pit sulfide mine just 150 feet from the Menominee. That plan has already been controversial with locals, who worry about the impact to water quality and wetlands. But after several years, the company has secured the last of the major permits it needs to break ground, despite concerns from DEQ and EPA staff members. I talked to Detroit Free Press reporter Keith Matheny, who's been covering this story. So before we get into the many controversies surrounding this specific mine, tell us a little bit about what an open pit mine looks like and what it does to the land.
Well, what they're proposing is something like a 2,000-foot by 2,500-foot hole that would go about 700 feet down into the ground. So it is literally kind of what it sounds like, a big, gigantic hole. They would also have processing facilities right there on the same site, where they would take what they're mining out of the pit and do various processes, including some that use cyanide to separate the ores that they're trying to get.
So you write that the lifespan of this mine is projected to be about 7 years, and that the controversy surrounding what it could be doing to the environment is both while it's being mined and after it's filled in after that 7 years, right?
Correct. I mean, one of the county commissioners up there told me he's never seen or heard of a sulfide mine anywhere that didn't kind of leave scars upon the land after its closure. Just think about the concept of what you're doing at a mine like this, and then imagine trying to, quote unquote, fix it. It's hard to imagine exactly how you can do that without, you know, causing some disruption to the local ecology.
Part of the controversy that also has drummed up has been around Native American tradition. Talk a little bit about what this area represents for the communities up there.
So the Menominee Indian Tribe of Wisconsin, this is a very culturally significant river to them. Their creation story stems from the river. The tribal chairman was telling me that one of the first stories of their creation is that the first being, the Great Bear, came out of Lake Michigan and set foot on the mouth of the Menominee River to kind of start their tribe's existence. And it's still an area where they hunt, where they gather, where people live, and significantly, burial mounds of their ancestors can be found all along this river, including some areas that could be impacted by the mine.
And do they have any legal recourse against this project?
Well, right now, the tribe is one of a couple of appellants trying to appeal this recent, I'm going to call it a wetlands and surface waters permit approval. The state of Michigan has approved the permits for how this project will impact wetlands and surface waters. The tribe is among those who are currently appealing that permit approval before an administrative law judge in Lansing. That's kind of their recourse now. One of the things that they're significantly concerned about is on the Wisconsin side of this river, the impacts from this mine are a stone's throw away. But because it's a Michigan process, they sort of feel like they've been left on the sidelines. The tribe says when they're dealing with a federal agency, you know, they're treated as a sovereign nation that's sort of at the table. Whereas in this, it's sort of been the state of Michigan telling them, here's what we're doing. We're keeping you in the loop, but you don't really have a say in it other than, you know, your 2 minutes of public comment along with everybody else at some informational meeting.
Have tribes been successful in the past at stopping projects from moving forward because of the disruption to culture and tradition?
I can't speak specifically to mines. I just don't have that much knowledge base on that. But certainly tribal concerns have been given quite a bit of significance, particularly in federal courts. Whether that will happen before a state administrative law judge, I don't know. But one can imagine if they don't get satisfactory answers there, they might seek to appeal.
So let's talk about the concerns among DEQ and EPA staff. What were the main concerns they were raising?
So as part of this permit appeal before the administrative law judge, a number of internal documents from what was then known as the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, or DEQ, it now has a different name called Eagle these days, a number of their documents have been brought into evidence. And so it's made a number of things come to light about what DEQ staff who were actually on the ground evaluating this proposal thought of it. And consistently throughout those documents over, I'm going to say, the course of a couple of years, they regularly said, this isn't ready to go. There are problems here. And among the problems were that it was going to impact a significant amount of acreage, more of wetlands than the company was saying. They were saying that the method they were using to evaluate their impacts on wetlands and groundwater withdrawals was improper, that it was basically useless. And I saw multiple documents where staff members were saying the bad stuff out of the mine is going to make its way into the surface waters of the river, which of course means it's then going to, you know, flow on into northern Lake Michigan, as this is one of the major tributaries to the Great Lake.
Well, with all of these concerns raised, then why did those agencies then go ahead and approve the permits anyway?
That is a very good question. So all of this was kind of laid out in the record. And it gets a little bit complicated because Michigan is one of only two states in the country that administers federal Clean Water Act programs for the U.S. EPA. So in Michigan, the EPA says, DEQ, you handle this for us. But the EPA reserves the right to step in and weigh in and say what they think about something. On this project, in the spring of 2018, the EPA said, we don't want this permit approved because we don't think they've demonstrated that they're going to protect the water and the surrounding area. Within, you know, several weeks of that letter, Aquila Resources, the Canadian mining company behind the Back 40 Mine Project, holds a meeting with EPA staff in Chicago. They provide them with quote-unquote supplemental information, and all of a sudden EPA's position turned on a dime. They said, we agree that this project should proceed and that our concerns have been satisfied, and that to the extent that there's still unresolved issues here, the Michigan DEQ can write a permit and deal with those as they go along before any work starts. Because they did it that way, it put the Michigan DEQ on a clock. They had less than a month, basically, to either approve or disapprove of this permit, or else their authority on it would revert back to the feds. So in that kind of quick time frame, the state agreed to approve the permits with a whole raft of conditions that Aquila Resources needed to meet before they could actually do the work there. And what critics like the tribe are saying is, since when do you take a permit and take all the conditions that are usually required to be in place to even get the permit, and instead you approve it and say, well, we'll work that stuff out later?
Okay, so you also ran into transparency issues, that the DEQ and the mining company did conspire to hide information from being FOIA'd, essentially, by the public.
There's a few documents in the DEQ's kind of appeals evidence here, and they show one DEQ staffer's sort of recaps of telephone conversations she'd had with Aquila Resources officials. And in those phone calls, she indicated that they were concerned about certain information, you know, going into the public record where the public could see it and react negatively to it. Now, in an earlier conversation where this was brought up by an Aquila executive, the DEQ sort of said, no, you know, if you send us a document, it becomes a public document and the public can see it. In a later phone call recap, the document shows that the staffer said an Aquila attorney had worked out a deal with Teresa Seidel, the chief of the DEQ Water Resources Division, that a document could be hosted on a GoToMeeting web meeting so that the DEQ could see it, but that it would, quote, not become an official part of the public record, end quote. So, you know, some folks who are advocates for First Amendment transparency believe that was sort of an effort to circumvent what's required under the Freedom of Information Act, that if you're a public agency and you're considering a permit and that applicant submits documents to you, that seems like something the public should be able to see. They held this meeting on the web so that they could look at it but not have it, so it wouldn't show up in a FOIA request.
Okay, so all of this happened before a new governor came in. This is in 2018 when these permits were approved, right?
That is correct.
So then does that change things with the new administration? Can this new department, Eagle, that has replaced DEQ, can they come in and change the permitting process, or is that already well underway and we can't back up?
It might be difficult for them to change the approved permits. Now again, they do have some recourse here in that, for example, they're requiring that Aquila Resources evaluate groundwater and evaluate wetlands the way that DEQ, now Eagle, wants to see it done. And that process involves like putting monitoring wells at the site, evaluating, you know, the different water fluctuations in different seasons, and doing it like over the course of a year to get sort of a full snapshot. It's my understanding that that process is ongoing right now. So they do have some recourse. They can kind of force the way things are going to go before any shovels hit the dirt there. But as the critics say, you've taken away the leverage of, or else you're not going to get this permit. You've already said they have the permit. Now we're just working out the details.
Keith Matheny, an environment reporter from the Detroit Free Press. Thanks so much, Keith.
Thank you.
Coming up next, we'll talk to the new president of Michigan State University. He was hired in the wake of the numerous controversies surrounding disgraced sports doctor Larry Nassar.
I would hope, you know, 2 years from now, a year from now, that, you know, we will be invited to talk about how one responds to this kind of thing and how one makes a safer campus and a campus with a better climate.
My conversation with President Samuel Stanley next on Stateside. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Samuel Stanley Jr. is the new president of Michigan State University. He was previously president of Stony Brook University in New York. Stanley arrives at MSU during a time of healing and rebuilding after a series of high-profile controversies surrounding the disgraced sports doctor and serial sexual abuser Larry Nassar. Here to talk about his vision for the future of Michigan State is Samuel Stanley. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
So what drew you to Michigan State in the first place?
You know, it's an amazing institution, the Pioneer Land-Grant Institution, a place with extraordinary scope and scale, and that means impact. And one of the things that, you know, being a university president, one of the things you strive for is the opportunity, I think, to have impact, to make a difference in people's lives. And Michigan State University does that for the state, for the region, for the U.S., and for the world. So the opportunity to lead a school like that, I think, is special. And so I wanted to take it on.
Well, you were president of Stony Brook University in New York for 10 years. Michigan State's problems have been well publicized. I'm sure you heard about them on the East Coast. From my perspective, Michigan State's image was hurt academically, its academic stature on a national scale. Would you agree that Michigan State's image had been hurt?
I think it's what happened was horrific, and I think people recognize the extraordinary tragedy of what's taking place at MSU. I'm not sure how much, honestly, that translated to a decline in the respect for the research and the kind of scholarship that goes on there. But it certainly was viewed as an institution that's having challenges. I think the fact that other institutions are having challenges at the same time to some sense might mitigate some of this, but I don't want to underplay how, you know, the horrific tragedy that took place at MSU, but rather just to say that maybe at least in the academic world, people divorced to some degree what's happening in research and scholarship there versus what was happening with the incident.
Well, how do you begin to tackle some of those issues?
The first thing, obviously, is to listen and learn and really make an effort to understand what those issues are. I think that begins with, and one of the clear things I want to do early on is meet with survivors and understand their issues and concerns and their experiences. That needs to help guide, I think, some of the actions we're taking. The next thing, I think, is to really understand culture and climate, and they've just completed a 15,000-person survey of faculty, staff, and students in MSU. The data from that will be coming out, so I think that will help guide. And then obviously paying attention to the multiple investigations that have taken place to understand where are areas where our policies and procedures broke down, where are areas where we may have been understaffed, where are areas where people didn't know what their responsibilities were, or if they knew them, they failed to act on them. So I think all those things, and I think there's a lot of information out there already that I think is going to be helpful, but I think we want to build from what happened and, again, develop the most safe and inclusive campus we have. So a lot of these first few months, I think, are going to be listening to understand this. But there's also a number of actions that have taken place and taking a look and making sure those were the right things to do and to make sure that we're investing in those that we need to invest in.
You said, and you have said before, that you are planning on meeting with survivors of Larry Nassar. Have you been able to speak with any of them yet?
So, no, not directly, but that will take place in September. So we're working now. So we have a relation to violence and sexual misconduct advisory group. So they're serving as a liaison for us with the survivor communities, and that would be not just survivors of Nassar, but survivors of sexual assault in the MSU community. And so we'll have meetings with those groups, and we're working to get them arranged now. We wanted to wait till people get back on campus in September, but I think those meetings will take place in September.
So there's a sense that when a new president comes in, it kind of brings forth a new era for a university, maybe a clean slate. Does Michigan State have any remaining responsibilities when it comes to the Larry Nassar scandal?
I think, again, part of that is, you know, why I'm here in these early days is to understand what those responsibilities are. I think that we need to, again, work with the communities, all survivors on our campus, but work with all other constituents as well to understand what we can do better. One of the things I think that we want to do at Michigan State University is really have a strategic plan for diversity, equity, and inclusion. That's something the university hasn't had in the past, and I think is another need. I think it's all about creating a culture of safety, of being welcome, and of diversity and inclusion on campus. So I think all those things come together.
Before the Larry Nassar scandal broke, the university had received some negative attention and headlines for its treatment of sexual assault survivors in general. How do we begin to turn the tide when it comes to these major institutions? It's hard to keep track of many, many students, but how do we begin to turn that cultural tide where women and all people are feeling safe on campus and around the campus areas?
So it's incredibly important, and it takes a lot of work. I think the first is we really have to deliver on a system that people have confidence in, so people believe that if they make a report, that that report will be fairly investigated, that there's enough people we have on campus to do those investigations in a timely and effective manner, and that we have, as I said, the policies and processes in place that people report when they should report. All that, I think, is policies, procedures, and adequate staffing and training. And then I think education awareness of the campus is huge. And we've put a lot of investment before I came, and we're going to continue to in prevention, outreach, and education. And that's critically important. So we really do have to kind of change culture, as you talked about, Laura. And the key to that, I think, one of the keynesses is awareness and education. So we've reached, as I mentioned before, or I may have mentioned, we've reached 72,000 people in training last year. That's incredibly important. But we need to find different ways to reach people. It's not enough just to do online. One needs to have in-person. One needs to be able to develop things like bystander programs to help people know how to react when something's happening in front of them. How do you react to be constructive and make a difference? All these things, I think, need to take place. And I think over time, hopefully, we'll earn trust again in our systems and what we do. I think that really will make a difference in changing culture. So I think those are the important first steps.
I want to talk about diversity and inclusion as well. You mentioned that, and I was looking at the demographics for Stony Brook and for Michigan State, which these major institutions here in the state have struggled to ensure that the populations are diverse. How do you go about turning the tide to looking maybe more like Stony Brook, which is a smaller scale, but you still had to tackle that clearly?
So I think that's, again, a very important challenge, and there's multiple layers that one needs to work on. So the first is to make sure that we're adequately recruiting and targeting students of color and underrepresented minorities in our region. That's very important. Then I think most of all is student success, making sure we're doing everything we can so those students succeed at the university. Of course, we care about the success of all students at the university, but some of the students who come from economically disadvantaged backgrounds may have some handicaps in terms of the high schools they attended, what extra help they get in studying, study habits, and so on. So we had a couple programs at Stony Brook University that I think were very effective in helping economically disadvantaged students succeed, and those included summer programs to help get them adapted into the university, programs of tutoring, mentoring, peer mentoring programs. And I think all of those things helped us address what were some gaps between students at the university. So we were able to abolish the gaps in graduation rates between Pell Grant eligible students and non-Pell eligible students, so it's a measure of income. We were able to abolish the gaps between black and white students in graduation rates and between Hispanic and white students in graduation rates. So it was a long-term effort. It's not something that was turned around in days or years, even a few years. I was there 10 years, and it took a number of years for us to get to that point. But I think it's we wanted to talk about those kind of strategies and employ them. But the second thing that's really important is getting more diversity in faculty and staff. And that's what I've found to be most challenging is how one gets to that goal. It really involves getting rid of implicit biases in recruiting. It involves being more aggressive about creating pools of applicants that have diversity, not proceeding with searches if you don't have diverse pools, particularly at senior leadership levels. All these things have to take place because one of the things I heard from my students at Stony Brook was we don't see enough people who look like us among some of our students of color. There's not enough people who look like us. We don't have the role models for people. So that's a huge challenge, and I think it's one, again, that I look forward to working with our entire community to address.
Between a lack of diversity and the issues that we have been seeing surrounding the Larry Nassar scandal, we're talking about a major cultural change that needs to happen. I'm just curious how you start to turn the tide when it comes to culture.
So I think, first of all, it has to start with me and at the top. It has to be clear to everyone in the institution that this is something I value and care about, that this matters to me, and I'm going to hold people accountable, essentially, for their performance in that area. One of the things that I instituted at Stony Brook was reviews when I met with my senior leadership team. We would constantly go through what was the makeup of their units, what were new hiring they were going through, what was the pools look like in the hiring pool. Really pushed the fact that this mattered to me and how I evaluated their performance was their efforts to increase diversity in their organizations, and that was really important. And then I think for students, again, the kind of training we can do to make sure that even when they come, what we did at Stony Brook was even before they arrived in pre-orientation, we had things about diversity, about cultural competency training that went on our campus, to all designed to try and improve campus climate. So I think all these things are important in changing culture, but I really do believe that people have to believe that the institution values it and cares about it and that it's a priority for them. And I think if you start there, it becomes easier to do. It's never easy, but it has to be. It has to be clear to everybody that the senior leadership team has bought into this.
You know, if culture change happens, as you say, as from the top down, in an article I read recently, one of your main critics from Stony Brook basically said you don't have the bedside manner to change the psychology, if you will, of a student body or make them feel comforted. Is that a fair assessment?
Obviously, I don't think so. And I think really I would be judged by my actions and deeds rather than that assessment. I talked about some of the progress we made in those areas, and I think that's probably what I'd rather be judged by. I think it is really important that one be accessible. I think that is important that one be willing to go to events, talk to people about this again, communicate to the campus how important these issues are to me. And I think I did that at Stony Brook.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm speaking with Samuel Stanley Jr., the new president of Michigan State University. I think it's fair to say that there is a lack of trust with MSU's administration right now. Do you think that it's sort of passed down that you're going to have to be combating the ills of the previous administrations and have to work to first repair that relationship? Or do you think that because you're new, that you'll be able to get in early with students and faculty?
You know, that's a great question, Laura, and I think I don't really know the answer to that yet. I know that I'm going to work very hard to earn people's trust, and that I think based on, you know, doing the things I say I'm going to do. I mean, we've talked about a lot of things today, but the question is, am I going to do them? And I think by doing those things and being committed to the things I talked about today to actually implementing them, I think that's how you start to earn trust. And so I expect people will expect some new things from me and expect some, perhaps some improvements from me. But I think really I have to earn trust, and that's what I look forward to doing.
So this is obviously a period of great change for Michigan State, as it is any time a new president starts, but it's also a period of great change for you personally and professionally. Are there aspects of your professional approach that you are reevaluating or reconsidering as you make this shift for yourself?
So that's a great question. And I think one of the things, again, is we talked a little bit about is being even more open in communications and communicating more, perhaps, than I did at Stony Brook. I think sometimes it's easy when you're leading a large institution like that to take for granted that people know what your goals are, what your aspirations are, because you do talk about them to audiences and so on. But I think it doesn't always get generally communicated. And so one of the things I did at Stony Brook that I'm going to continue at MSU is I'm really going to reach out to meet as many faculty, staff, and students as I can. I'm going to be living on campus, so that will help in the process. But amazingly enough, yes, yeah. I'm going to live there. Living there now, actually.
Okay.
But I think the other thing is, at Stony Brook, I started a policy of meeting with all the departments of the university. It usually took me about a year and a half to do it. I think there's more than 100 at Michigan State. But that's a chance for me to really do a Q&A with every faculty member at the university. So I'm going to continue that. I'm going to find more ways to meet students. I developed a dinner program where I had dinner with students in their dorms and did that a couple times a month, set up office hours. Any way I think I can be more accessible and communicate more, I think, is going to be helpful, because it's really important. We've talked about the trust issues, and so I want to be out there so people can see me and hear what I have to say.
It's funny thinking about being more relatable when you're talking about a university that you're going up so much in scale and the number of people you'll have to meet or shake hands with. But also, I feel like maybe a president of a large university is more visible in their community. Would you say that's true?
I think it is true. And I think because of some of the venues we have and so on, there's actually more chance for me, I think, to get in front of the campus, and I'm going to take advantage of it in every way I can. That's going to occupy a lot of my time early on, and I'm going to try and spend a lot of time on campus. When I was at Stony Brook, one of my goals was really to be on campus president for the first few years. Now, there's important responsibilities for fundraising and other things that may take me away from campus, but I'm going to do everything I can to stay on campus and be visible.
What are you anticipating to see among the student body when they return in the fall? What do you anticipate your interactions will be with them?
I think it's, again, going to be listening, obviously, and understanding. I think it's, you know, understanding kind of who they are, what they're interested in, what they expect from the university, what they believe they need from the administration. All those things, I think, are important. I've really always enjoyed my interactions with students, and I would say that's probably the thing I enjoyed most about being a university president, was interactions, particularly, honestly, with the undergraduate students, because they're so enthusiastic generally. They're so excited about their education. The students at Stony Brook were excited to be at Stony Brook University. They really, you know, wanted to be a part of it. We're concerned. I expect to find the same in MSU, obviously, just from the pride I've seen from people around, how much they care about the institution. I think I'll see the same thing. And so understanding how I can be helpful to them and having conversations about their lives. It's interesting, a lot of students ask me about pre-med. What was it like to be a pre-med? And of course, you know, that happened for some time ago. So I'm not sure my information's all up to date. But I think, you know, they want to relate their experiences to maybe experiences I've had as well. So it's just always fun to talk to them. And I think it's going to be great.
Before I let you go, I want to ask you about the relationship between Michigan State and the attorneys general that have come through and been critical of the university and said that the relationship in this investigation hasn't been fully collaborative and that Michigan State was essentially withholding information. What is the current standing of that relationship, and do you see your administration changing that relationship?
I think, it's primarily been an issue, obviously, between the Board of Trustees and the Attorney General in terms of releasing documents that are under attorney-client privilege. And so it's not something that I've been directly engaged in. I really see my job as, again, as we've talked about, as working to move forward, essentially, in terms of understanding everything we can about what's happened. There's a Clery investigation. There was an internal investigation that Michigan State did. There's the investigation by the Attorney General and the subsequent indictments. And so I'm really focused on that, and I think the board is really in those discussions of what would next with the Attorney General.
Lastly, how would you measure success for Michigan State and for yourself?
I think the parameters are the same we talked about. So I think the objective parameters relate to student success, our graduation rates. They relate to our applications and making sure we continue to have great applicants that can succeed at Michigan State University. And there are things like dollars in research and how much we've grown over a period of time. I think those are measures of success. But importantly for this job will also be our climate surveys, understanding how people feel about the university, really taking a look at how we're handling issues around sexual misconduct and making sure our policies are considered among the best in the country. And I would hope, you know, 2 years from now, a year from now, that, you know, we will be invited to talk about how one responds to this kind of thing and how one makes a safer campus and a campus with a better climate. And that's my hope, that we'll be seen as an exemplar in this area. That's a tall order and a lot of work to do, but that's my hope going forward.
Samuel Stanley Jr. is the new president of Michigan State University. President Stanley, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Lauren. Thank you for taking the time.
After the break, we'll talk about the link between climate change and human health and what that means for people in Michigan. That's next on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Beyond an impact on the environment, climate change is expected to affect human health, and it already is. A state agency has identified 5 areas we can see this happening: heat-related illness, breathing problems, waterborne diseases, bug-related illnesses, and even an uptick in carbon monoxide poisoning. Here to talk about all of this is Lori Cameron and Aaron Ferguson. They are with the Michigan Climate and Health Adaptation Program. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about whether or not we are already seeing changes in health because of climate change. Have you seen any indication that things are changing for public health?
I think we are seeing effects on health, and that's been noted internationally and with the U.S. You may be aware that the WHO has declared climate change the existential public health emergency of our lifetimes and of our century. And that certainly is true across the world, where we're seeing extreme weather causing multitudes of deaths. But even within Michigan, we're seeing changes in patterns of disease that can be linked at least partially to some of the changes we're seeing in the climate.
Sure, like what?
Well, for example, people are aware that there's new vector-borne diseases moving into the state, such as Lyme disease and West Nile virus. Now, back when I was a kid, you know, many years ago, these conditions were not seen in the state of Michigan, but as temperatures have warmed and as the environment has changed, it's promoted the spread of mosquitoes and ticks that carry these infectious diseases. And so now certain parts of our state are dealing with emerging threats from Lyme disease and West Nile virus.
It seems like every year when I look at the map of the state where you can find ticks that carry Lyme disease or could carry Lyme disease, it seems like that map, that heat map, is kind of spreading farther and farther out into various parts of the state.
That's correct.
So let's talk about what other things we're seeing. Aside from vector-borne diseases, what else are the main concerns that you're focusing in on?
Both nationally and here in Michigan, we're concerned about just the rise in temperatures and the increase in heat-related illness. Hmm. And you probably are aware of some of the heat waves that have been occurring in Europe this summer and the many deaths associated with that. We don't tend to think of Michigan as being a very hot climate, but we do get extreme heat days, and we do see increases in hospitalizations, in emergency room visits, and even increases in deaths associated with those increasing temperatures.
Aaron, looking at the potential impacts and the places that we're seeing more of a problem, who are the populations that we're focusing in on? Who are you most concerned about?
Yeah, so in general, we're concerned about those that are most vulnerable to these climate impacts. And so those would be those that are elderly, the very young, those that might be experiencing poverty or homelessness, certainly in urban areas, those that live in those urban areas might be more exposed to those high heat events, because in those urban areas, it tends to get even hotter than in the surrounding areas. And other parts of the state, maybe more in the country, and then even in the urban areas, we see people that are vulnerable to extreme precipitation events, so that's heavy rain in the summer and heavier snow and even ice in the winter, which can cause flooding. So in areas that have older infrastructure, in urban areas, if the stormwater systems aren't designed for the amount of rain that they're seeing, you'll get street flooding, flooding backing up into people's basements, and then closing roads. In rural areas, we see the more socially isolated populations during events that if their transportation routes get cut off, they get cut off from essential needs and potentially emergency services, and that can be a problem for those populations.
So how do we begin to tackle some of these issues in the Great Lakes state? Do we see anything that can be done on the state level?
So at the state level, our program has been working across agencies with our counterparts in EGLE and MDOT and the DNR to educate them and make them aware of how climate impacts health, and then discuss ways that we can incorporate public health into their programs and projects. And we've taken that approach, and we've also worked a lot at the community level. So our program's been around since 2010, and during that time, we've really focused on helping communities and local health departments and community-based organizations build their capacity to respond to these climate changes and these health impacts from climate change. So some examples of that would be in Detroit. We've been working with the Detroit Health Department and groups and community-based organizations there to help them better plan and respond to both heat and cold events, and help the health department build that capacity, and help the, even at the neighborhood level, help them raise the awareness of, you know, checking in with their neighbors during these cold and heat events. We've also been working in Marquette County in Michigan's Upper Peninsula with partners at Michigan State University Extension and the Marquette County Health Department to take their quite substantial existing climate plans and help them incorporate the public health components into their existing plans. So that would be things like taking their master plan and how do you incorporate health-based policies into that would help them adapt to the ongoing climate changes.
Aaron, is it hard to get the public to see public health and health in general as a climate change-related issue?
It can be at first, but I think more communities now are experiencing it firsthand. You know, every spring it seems like in the Southeast Michigan they're experiencing major flooding events. They saw those types of major flooding events in the Houghton area, in the Upper Peninsula. And in those same years, they might also be experiencing drought and, as Lori alluded to, some of the asthma conditions. So as time has gone on, I think more communities are starting to experience the impacts from that, and that kind of brings them to the table and start asking questions about what can we do to be better prepared for these situations.
And is that really what we need to be discussing, is preparedness for the future, or is there a way to address some of these issues now to reduce or eliminate them altogether?
Oh, I think we definitely need to be responding now to these threats, because the threats are here now. And as Aaron mentioned, people are recognizing these events are occurring now. There are things we can do. There's a lot that can be done on the local level. And even though there is no national policy right now that's addressing these issues, a lot of the mayors across the country and even within our state are moving forward with plans both to try to reduce the pace of climate change by reducing what's called greenhouse gases, such as reducing fossil fuel burning, but also to adapt, and that is to intervene so that the effects that we are seeing now are not harming people. A lot of the mayors and community leaders throughout our state are starting to look at infrastructure very critically to see what do we need to do to prevent these floods from harming people? What do we need to do to prevent the cities from getting so hot in the summer when we have a heat event? And there's actions that can be taken on multiple levels. The healthcare community is also responding. There are groups such as the Physicians for Social Responsibility that are reaching out to their colleagues in the medical profession, educating them to educate their patients about ways to stay safe when it's hot out or when the air quality is bad, and to make the connection that these effects are coming from climate change.
Lorraine Cameron is the principal investigator for the Michigan Climate and Health Adaptation Program. Aaron Ferguson is the program manager of that same program. Thank you both for joining the program today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to who might be most affected by these threats to human health. You likely know the name Abdul El-Sayed from his run for governor in Michigan. But before trying his hand at politics, he was focused on public health as the head of the City of Detroit's health department. He says the links between climate and health reveal some startling inequalities in society. Abdul El-Sayed, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
You argue that communities of color are disproportionately affected by the negative health implications of climate change. Why?
Well, let's think about the history of racism and the way that it's wrapped itself around the places that people have often been forced to live in marginalized communities. And if you go back to post-World War II, and you know that's a part of American history that a lot of folks look back at fondly. But if you look at the record of policy, so much of it was about marginalizing people of color into communities that were less desirable. And then also marginalizing them out of jobs that were less desirable. And even if they had the same jobs, those records of payment were worse. And so you create and perpetuate this systematic injustice. And then when you think about what climate change will do, it will introduce an environmental assault on people. And those who are best able to cope are those for whom wealth and access and comfortable neighborhoods and big houses and stable jobs are most likely to protect them. And for folks who have been systematically marginalized over a long period of time, we're going to see quite the opposite. That means that we have a lot of work to do to be thinking about how to protect these communities from the consequences of climate change.
So do you anticipate that the effect will be environmental, or will it be about access to care?
It'll be both. It'll be both who is most likely to be hurt by both the production of climate change and also the consequences of climate change, and then also who will have access to the means of mitigating those consequences. So if you go to Southwest Detroit, and we have some of the highest concentration of climate change causing gases being emitted from a lot of the factories in that airshed. And the EPA has said that that particular community is in what's called non-compliance, meaning there's too much of the bad stuff in the air. And think about who lives in Southwest Detroit. They tend to be poor, African-American, and Latinx folks. And that's not about the consequence of climate change. That's about the cause of climate change, right? Is that you have these factories that are emitting into the air. And it's easy to explain why that happens. You have systematic redlining over decades that basically shunted poor, low-income, and predominantly people of color into those communities where they were forced to live in the airshed that was being polluted by those corporations. And then on the back end, when we think about these temperature fluctuations, when we think about the increases in what we used to call once in a lifetime or once in 500 year storms, who does it affect, right? Go back to this summer in particular. You had massive flooding where? In Southeast Detroit. And who tends to live there? Low-income people of color. And when we see systematic poverty because of the consequences of systematic racial oppression over a long period of time, well, then even the ability to do something about it on the back end is limited.
Well, let's talk about what this looks like practically. As temperatures warm, how do you see this manifesting?
What we're going to be seeing with climate change, a lot of folks focus on the warming, but it's really about the change in the climate as it tries to respond to an increased amount of greenhouse gases in the air. We're going to see warming, yes, but also colder winters. I mean, if you think about this last year alone, we had both the coldest winter on record and the hottest summer on record in terms of days. And so it's the experience of trying to protect yourself against that. It's also the consequences of increased climate change related gases in the air. So that will cause asthma. It's also the fact that that as storms are more likely to happen, these once-in-a-lifetime storms happen every summer, the consequences of that in terms of lost property, in terms of lost housing, in terms of lost people, right? That affects people's mental health in some pretty profound ways. The amount of insecurity that comes with knowing that all of a sudden your house is gone, you don't have the insurance to be able to pay to fix it, and what that does in terms of displacing people, who is that going to affect most? It's going to affect most likely the most marginalized people in our society.
So you're talking about long-term and short-term health implications.
Yeah.
How does a department even begin to tackle that?
Well...
Yeah, I mean, it's heavy because you're dealing with a fundamental shift in how a city is run. What part of the apple do you bite first?
And this is the point, right? If we are not serious about tackling climate change itself, there's going to be very little that a city, even a state, can do to address the consequences. We have to tackle the crisis at the level which the crisis was created at. And right now, one of the big focuses that we really have to think about is what does it mean to free our energy system from a dependence on oil, stuff that we literally pull out of the ground and then burn into the lungs of our children that then go into the atmosphere and accelerate climate change. That has to be a national level priority, in fact, an international level priority. And it was, except for the international agreements that were meant to govern that, we pulled out of. Why? Because the other problem is that so many of these companies have a huge stake in our politics. And unless we're able to address that problem at the international and national level, there's going to be very little that a city can do, a state can do, right? So much of the funding that they use to do those things in the first place comes from the feds. The way I think about it, in terms of what our state ought to be doing right now, is number one, we've got to get serious about playing our part on this issue. So when you think about an issue like Line 5, it's easy to just say, well, we're talking about an oil pipeline in one particular part of Michigan territory. But actually, it has far bigger implications than that. If that oil pipeline were to fail in some way and leak natural gas into the Great Lakes, you're now talking about 21% of the world's fresh water. That's a big deal internationally. All to do what? To protect a system of energy production that forces us to move huge amounts of natural gas so somebody can burn it. We can do better.
But, you know, getting back to the Paris Climate Accord and international agreements, even climate scientists agreed that that wasn't going to go far enough. It was just a start. And yes, it's not great from a climate perspective that we are trying to withdraw ourselves from it. But if we're talking about on the international policy and the national policy perspective, that's a huge mountain that needs to be climbed. But on a state level, a city level, an individual level, are there things that can be done to tackle even the larger issues, to
sure.
tackle the public health issue?
Yeah. So, you know, make no mistake, Michigan is a state of 10 million people. And there's a lot that we as a state can do that I think focuses on driving forward on 100% renewable energy. That as individuals, it means petitioning our government officials to get there. It also means, you know, the classic things, reduce, reuse, recycle. It means making smart choices about investing in mass transit rather than continuing to be wedded to a system of transportation that's focused on every one of us getting into our own car individually and driving 25.4 minutes, which is the average commute time, all the while putting the burn off of fossil fuels into the air. It also means thinking about infrastructure in a real thoughtful way. One of the main challenges we face as a state right now is that our infrastructure is crumbling, but it's got to go beyond the things that we see like roads. It's also got to be thinking about, well, what is our energy grid looking like? How do we move water? And are there ways to do that in a much more efficient way that saves those resources and also protects us? And it's also recognizing that some infrastructure is a lot more important for low-income people of color than others, right? Every time, for example, when it rains and it floods in a community like Detroit, that's an infrastructure issue.
Right.
And we have to be thinking about what is our society-wide investment in protecting the most vulnerable of us by building the infrastructure that would do that.
Abdul El-Sayed, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's it for today. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors today are April Van Buren, Adam Reyes, Catherine Newhan, and Anna Schlute. I'm Laura Weber-Davis in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much. We'll see you tomorrow.